Welcome to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, pulls it apart and weaves the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. I'm your host, Anna Staver. This season, we're untangling redistricting in Ohio. Redistricting is the process of putting lines down over a state map that determine where our politicians come from, shapes that group us together by city, community, and sometimes voting preference. That last one, where districts pack together or split apart voters by political parties, that's called gerrymandering. It's where politicians use the map-making process to manipulate the outcome of future elections. And that's bad, right? People should pick their politicians. Politicians shouldn't pick their people. We wanted to untangle why it's bad this season. Learn the real-world impacts of gerrymandering on our laws, our businesses, and our communities. The answer I got most often when asking the simple question, why is gerrymandering bad, is that it breeds extremism. That skewing who represents us also skews the policies that shape our lives.
When you don't have any accountability whatsoever, which gerrymandering creates, you create a system where all the incentives are the opposite of public service.
That's David Pepper. He's the former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party and the author of a book about gerrymandering called Laboratories of Autocracy. Pepper says distorted districts make for distorted laws.
People in office in a gerrymandered system where almost not a single one of them faces a real election their entire careers, their incentive goes from being mainstream to being an extremist. Their incentive goes from serving broader public goods to serving private narrow interests. And that's why FirstEnergy and payday lenders and for-profit charter schools, in a gerrymandered world, they get everything they want. Because they can determine who wins the primary, and extremism makes sure you win the primary. And since the general election doesn't matter, you know, you can't lose even if you're doing unpopular things by the general public. So a gerrymandered world incentivizes all the worst behavior that is passing law after law after law that reflect the opposite of the views of the majority of the state. What happened with issue one last November, a perfect example.
Issue 1 was about reproductive rights. It was a constitutional amendment that guaranteed access to abortion up until viability, and it passed with 57% of the vote. The amendment passed in counties like Butler and Delaware, which have traditionally been GOP strongholds in Ohio. It passed in parts of Appalachia. It passed in a state where the Republican legislature had spent a decade passing some of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. Here's Jen Miller from the League of Women Voters.
When lawmakers, and nearly every lawmaker in the state house, knew they were going to win their seat again. When that happens, who do they have to please? Well, they're only going to win their seat once they win their primary. So they have to play to primary voters, which are party extremes, right? They're not playing to the general population.
And it's usually about 20-ish percent of the party. So it's the most extreme part of the party.
Right. And so you have a situation where any complicated issue, and we know that lawmakers have to deal with a lot of complicated issues, healthcare, transportation, environmental issues, public health, education. These are all very complicated issues that take an approach that is not ideological, but is disciplined in understanding the issues and coming up with the best solutions for the people. However, if the only way you win your seat again is to win your primary, you have to be ideological. And so in that way, a lot of the legislation in gerrymandered state houses doesn't matter if it's a gerrymandered state house Republican or gerrymandered state house Democrat. Those policies that can be passed are well out of step with the people of that state.
I think abortion is such an interesting example of this because the heartbeat bill passes in 2019. Governor Mike DeWine signs it. It bans abortions after about 6 weeks. So that's essentially 2 weeks after a missed period because we start counting 4 weeks before you're pregnant, which is like weird. And I do not fully understand to this day. I've had two children and I do not understand why we count this way. But it's not 6 weeks after you get pregnant. That's just like not how it works. But it's before most women know they're pregnant. There's no exceptions for rape. There's no exceptions for incest. And then our state votes like 57% for a Roe standard.
Yeah.
I mean, what the people of Ohio wanted and what that law was just feels wildly divergent.
Yeah. And the only accountability was going to the ballot box, because you can't vote these lawmakers out because the maps have been rigged to guarantee their reelection.
The other thing Miller says gerrymandering does to a state is make it harder for politicians to represent districts on issues they actually care about.
We've been looking at Congressional District 6, and, you know, there's little towns like Gnadenhutton that could fit into Congressional District 6 649 times. But it's split into two different congressional districts. There's all these little tiny school districts that only have one or two buildings that are split between the 6th and the 12th or the 6th and the 13th. That's not a community of interest, right? When we're splitting folks apart simply for partisan advantage, that's not a community of interest.
You could argue that a school district is definitely a community of interest, all the children that go to the same school.
Right, absolutely. And if you think about it, this is where it really matters, because both Congress and the State House pass a whole bunch of education policies. And it becomes hard if you have to advocate for your school district to multiple lawmakers in Congress or multiple lawmakers in the State House, because you're just such a tiny little piece of the pie that those lawmakers have to consider. Even when lawmakers want to have quality representation, they want to represent the needs of their constituents. When we have these weird shaped, sprawling districts that slice and dice school districts and communities and townships for no other reason than partisan advantage, makes it nearly impossible for a lawmaker to do their job well.
Do you think competition makes for better lawmakers?
Absolutely.
That's House Minority Leader Allison Russo.
Having real elections that you have to get out and talk to voters at the door and hear from voters and continuously engage with your constituents and voters, even when you're in elected office continuously, makes you a much better legislator. Not only are you more in touch with what your community, what they care about, but I think you are also, you work harder because you want to be able to go back to your community and say, these are the results that I'm delivering for you as a community. And overall, I would argue that there are exceptions to this, but some of the very best lawmakers that we have come from districts that are not lopsided either way, because they are continually having to engage with their constituents or they won't have a job.
I do want to ask you the big picture question. Like, what is the impact of gerrymandering? Why should people care, especially if their party is the one drawing the lines?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think the biggest reason why people should care is because ultimately you lose your power as a citizen in making sure that the person who is representing you, even if it's someone from your own political party, that they feel accountable to you.
Essentially, gerrymandering insulates politicians from the will of the people. And when you get supermajorities like we have here in Ohio, it insulates the legislature from the governor, giving the majority party enough votes to override vetoes and add emergency clauses to legislation that prevent citizens from gathering signatures to put that new law before the voters. It can also, in the opinion of former Ohio Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, make politicians feel like they can do whatever they want. O'Connor presided over the redistricting cases in 2022, siding with the court's Democratic minority to reject 5 sets of statehouse maps. And you can feel her frustration grow with each opinion that she handed down. By May of 2022, O'Connor wrote that she believed the redistricting commission's, quote, utter refusal to comply with this court's orders as rulings of law were proof that, quote, they can act in degradation of the law and against their oaths to uphold it. It was some harsh wording from the Chief Justice. And she continued, writing, quote, the Republican dominance of the General Assembly gave rise to a telling boast by President of the Senate Matt Huffman. We can kind of do what we want.
I think the idea there is we've got a supermajority. We can do whatever we want. And, you know, when you get elected, you stop thinking about all the people that voted for you and you start thinking about the population of the state, the citizens of the state. You don't pass laws. You don't govern for the people that put you in office. You govern for the good of the entire state. And I thought that that quote, I still think that quote, is indicative of a mindset that I don't agree with.
I want to take a moment and talk about that quote. We can kind of do what we want. Because it came from a profile I wrote about the Senate president when I was a legislative reporter for Gannett. Huffman said that to me while we were sitting on the deck of his law office in downtown Lima.
Well, I have to be very candid with you about that. I don't really remember saying that, but I'm certain that I did say it because of the veracity of the reporter who was doing that. And I think, I mean, that day we did lots of stuff. We were at my office and we went to the CUPE, I believe.
Yes, good burgers.
Yes, good burgers.
10 out of 10 recommend.
Yes. I think we went.
That we was went to the Honda Wind Tunnel.
Honda Wind Tunnel. I got a picture taken with my son, all that kind of stuff. So we were talking about a lot of things.
Yeah. This was the time also when Larry Householder has been expelled from the House. Bob Kupp is the new. There was a lot of stuff going on in 2022. And the thrust of the article was, OK, so the House is kind of a mess. And then the governor isn't super popular with his own party, which leaves the Senate. Because traditionally there's the big three, right? There's
sure.
the Senate president,
right.
the House Speaker, and the governor.
Yeah.
And the three of them have a lot of power over legislative agendas. I think Householder had been expelled at that point, which was a whole other really big thing. It was first time in 100 years.
I think that's right. Yeah, yeah. That's
so
right.
Householder's been expelled. We haven't had the trial yet, but the governor is in this, like, difficult position because the party isn't super happy with him over COVID. And then there's you just, like, hanging out in the Senate. And so I wanted to write about that in that moment. So we were talking about that situation and, like, the circumstances. But I guess what I want to be clear about is we weren't talking about redistricting.
Yeah, well, absolutely. In terms of redistricting, whoever we would be, the Senate in a 7-member panel, the Republican Senate has one vote. You know, in terms of that particular moment in time, you know, I think, you know, the Senate was in a position that we were a very cohesive body. At that time, we had 25 Republican senators.
You had enough of a supermajority that you could let those guys go. They could vote no, vote their conscience, and still pass legislation.
Right, right.
Which is a pretty powerful position to
right.
be in.
Right. And you know, I when I was in the House with Bill Batchelder, we had 59 members in the first when he first became Speaker. And often people would come and say, well, you know, gee, I'd like to vote no on this, because, you know, it's not good for my district or whatever it is. And my answer as the majority leader, then Speaker Pro Tem, was, well, then vote no, you know, because we only need 50 votes to pass it.
Yeah.
And I've said that to my senators often. Now, does that mean we get to do whatever we want in the Senate? Of course not, because we got a House that has different ideas, a governor that has different ideas. I will say this. There's nothing that compares to real war. But when you talk about war and you talk about conflict and people, and we get to elections, people will feel like they can say just about anything in the moment.
I also think the context of the article is important, and that's not just because I think you should go read it. But I mean, I don't even work there anymore. So, but because the quote is in a section about how you were raised and who influenced how you govern. You talk about Bill Batchelder, former Speaker of the Ohio House, and how he would deputize people as experts on different subjects and how you do this too. And the quote that precedes it is, "You have to rely on their knowledge and trust those people," Huffman said. "You cannot keep the support of a group of people who are not elected by you if you're a dictator." So that's the quote that comes three paragraphs before the "we can do what we want" quote.
Yeah, well, I think that's always true. I mean, ultimately, if you don't listen to them, if you do just what you want, you don't last very long.
Matt Huffman thinks our current system of redistricting works, and not just because he's one of the guys who wrote it. He thinks if given the opportunity, it produces fair maps. And he thinks the Redistricting Commission didn't draw repeated unconstitutional maps. it's his opinion the court overstepped its bounds. Maureen O'Connor, however, she's trying to reform the system. She saw what happened as a legislature run wild, and she wants to take redistricting away from politicians, give it to a board made up of people who have never run for office. We're going to be talking about this year's Issue 1 later on in the season. For now, for O'Connor, it comes down to a basic principle of American democracy.
You merely have to read the first words of the state constitution and the federal constitution. We, the people. All power comes from the people. Let's make sure that it's being used for our benefit.
When you ask business leaders the same question, why is gerrymandering bad? They talk about government and good politics, but they also talk about their own bottom line and why gerrymandering is bad for business. And we're going to talk about it when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Untangled. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're untangling redistricting in Ohio this season, and today is all about gerrymandering, how politicians manipulate district boundaries to benefit their friends while punishing their political enemies. Gerrymandering has obvious political impacts, but can also have economic consequences. It can, essentially, be bad for business. That's at least according to Jeff Birding, president and CEO of FC Cincinnati. He's an advocate for redistricting reform, and he joins us now. Jeff, I have the big question first. Why is gerrymandering bad for business?
It's bad for business because with gerrymandering, you really are removing accountability, and you're removing competitiveness, and you're breeding stagnation with the loss of innovation. And when you think about having a business or a sports team, you need accountability, you need competitiveness, and you need innovation. And gerrymandering is bad for business because it really does result in a lack of accountability where primary voters, less than 20% of Ohio voters, are choosing our legislature, and these leading to more extreme partisans. You have a lack of competition. One party knows they're going to win all the races in the district. It'd be like Ohio State knowing they're going to win the national championship by beating Heidelberg and Wittenberg maybe Bowling Green instead of needing to beat Michigan and Michigan State and Wisconsin. You have to have competition. That is the part of business that breeds innovation because you want to get ahead. You want to be better than your opponent. And I would offer that a competition of ideas is where innovation originates. So if you look at in Congress and in the General Assembly, we haven't had a real stable budget in years in Congress in Washington, D.C. In the Ohio General Assembly this year, legislators passed the fewest bills into law of any year since 1955. And before you joke that's a good thing, consider the priorities and important issues that are being overlooked that promote free enterprise, promote economic competitiveness and growth for the benefit of all Ohioans. If you just look at the statistics, Ohio is being passed by lots of states, and we're not really answering the bell of that competition. And I would say it is rooted in many respects in that we systemically have our elected officials who are safe from competition and accountability, again, in both parties.
One of the things that they say about gerrymandering is that it can make lawmakers less responsive to constituents. And I suspect that might also mean they would be less responsive to business owners in the community. If you're a big company, a multinational corporation, I assume you can overcome that, but I imagine that's a lot harder if you're a small business owner. Do you think the impacts of gerrymandering are felt more by our small businesses?
In many ways, yes. Again, if an elected official never has to fear their reelection, except maybe the loud voices of some primary voters, again, a very limited number of primary voters, they have no reason to be accountable to results in terms of looking to grow jobs. Just as an example, in the most recent statistics coming out of the state of Ohio, their own data, as well as some of the national data, we lost 10 to 40% of Ohio college graduates each year. They leave the state to pursue jobs and their lives elsewhere. They take, these are our highest performing people, our highest potential people, and they're taking their skills and incomes out of the state. Ohio's losing college graduates 12.2% more quickly than we draw in. And most often they're going to Illinois, New York, and California. And I would say that that brain drain is crushing to small business as we try to recruit talent, our businesses compete. In 2010, Ohio was ranked in the top six in public education. We're now ranked in the low to mid 20s. Our education system is not getting better. The Chamber, Ohio Chamber of Commerce, said that Ohio still needs 62,000 employees to reach pre-pandemic levels. Our top industries employment recovery is lagging behind the U.S., the national statistics. We're experiencing population loss. We're expected to lose 6% of our population between 2022 and 2050. It's about 675,000 residents. I could keep going on. My point is that the state is not responding to these challenges. The Ohio Chamber of Commerce put together an excellent, well-researched blueprint for Ohio's economic future in October of 22, and yet little to none of it has been implemented. And I would offer the answer why is because you don't have a legislature that feels compelled by competition that they have to rise to the moment to help us meet our challenges as a state. Because they're very comfortable in their safe districts that have been extremely gerrymandered.
Earlier, we talked about how gerrymandering increases the chance for hyper-partisan legislation, laws from both sides of the aisle, depending on who's in control, that might be out of step with where a majority of the people are. I wonder, how do you think that impacts a company's ability to attract and retain talent if they have laws that are very extreme on the left or very extreme on the right?
Well, I would offer, again, when the legislature, elected officials from both parties, are not responsive to general election voters, which, to be honest, is where, you know, 70-some percent of voters are voting only in the general election. It's fewer than 20% that are voting in primaries. So that's where the accountability lies. That's who's choosing our legislature. And yet the political middle, the center, which is representing over 70% of voters, has no voice. And so as a result, yes, legislation is being advanced that is backed by the people that vote in primary elections, which really doesn't represent the sort of common sense middle, the pragmatic middle that wants to see the state grow. I'll say again, our college graduates, we're losing them more than they're coming in, which hurts business. Well, guess what? They're not going to Arkansas, Mississippi, and Alabama. They're going to, according to the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, California, New York, and Illinois. Let's be honest, you know, those states that our college graduates are heading to, they're probably making a decision. They don't want to live in Ohio. There's something we're not addressing. We're not creating for them in Ohio. Our startup industry is lagging the national average in terms of startups and a welcome environment for entrepreneurs. Why? Why are they going to California, New York, and Illinois? And yet we're passing laws that may appeal to primary voters, but is turning off that talent to want to stay in Ohio, our best and brightest. We're not able to recruit entrepreneurs to move from the coast that may have high taxes. But maybe we have a higher quality of living here, but we're doing things that turn them off because we have legislators that are appealing to primary voters that are their guarantee to stay in office.
I came across this study from 2018 about the impacts of partisan redistricting on consumer credit, and it really surprised me. The conclusion was that the less competitive a district is, the harder it becomes for people to borrow money. Does that surprise you that it gets harder to borrow money in a gerrymandered district?
It doesn't surprise me, again, because extreme gerrymandering makes these elected officials so safe that they don't work as hard. They already have their job security, so they lose the incentive to advocate for constituents. It's normal human behavior. When you feel pressure to perform, you work harder, you produce more. And when you're comfortable, you produce less. And again, if you think about the marketplace, businesses who are doing less, who are producing less, tend to go out of business because they lose to competition. And here, these elected officials have no fear of competition, except for in a primary election, which means that the social issues, those issues that are most cared about, the biggest concern of primary voters, are the issues that they do tend to pay the most attention to, because otherwise they may lose. And elected officials, largely, one of the most important things is to not lose the next election.
What really surprised me about the study was the sort of control groups that they had. They looked at boundary changes that have no impact on credit. And that happens in states where they use independent or less partisan commissions to draw their districts. They sort of evaluate the districts for gerrymandering. And then in the ones where they don't find as much evidence of it, they don't see that credit loss. It's sort of like the control group in a science experiment. I was really fascinated by it.
Well, I think one of the other things that that study showed was that extreme gerrymandering really is a way to disenfranchise voters. Voters don't have a voice. They know they don't have a voice. And I think that when you don't have a voice in the political system, it could lead to less engagement overall. And less engagement overall can also lead to maybe other types of behaviors that maybe do also drive up credit scores.
I have to ask, you are the CEO of FC Cincinnati, you're one of its co-founders. How did you get involved in redistricting?
Well, I care about Ohio. I care about economic growth in Ohio. I like to see Ohio win. I don't like to see these stats that Ohio is losing to other states. I grew up in Cincinnati. I love Ohio. I'm a homer about Ohio. And I want to see Ohio win. And I think you can trace some of the decline and some of these statistics to extreme gerrymandering. And again, it's in both parties and other states. It's the Democrats that are using it as a tool. This isn't a partisan issue for me at all. I support lots of Republicans. I support lots of Democrats. I just want to see good government. I want to see Ohio win. And I'm just convinced that extreme gerrymandering has not been good for business, because you would never have a business where your employees are not accountable and where you're not rising to the competition that is inherent in a capitalist system. We compete with other businesses, we compete with one another, and we seek to win in the marketplace. And right now, Ohio is not winning in the political marketplace.
So safe to say you don't think that the redistricting that unfolded in 2021 and 2022 went very well?
No. I mean, it was ruled unconstitutional 7 times. Here's the other thing. You have to have integrity in the process and believe in the rule of law. You know, capitalism, free enterprise does not work well in Hungary, in Turkey, or in Russia, because they don't believe in the rule of law. Those are autocracies. And I only say that to say, when the voters of Ohio 2 times vote over 70% to end partisan gerrymandering for the 2020 election, it's those decisions, the will of the voters passed into law in the Ohio Constitution, are just ignored. And 7 times bipartisan Ohio Supreme Court says, unconstitutional, try again. And they just thwart the will of the voters. Again, you may not like the will of the voters, but it was the will of the voters. We have a representative democracy, and we believe in the rule of law. We're not Turkey or Russia or Hungary. And you can say, I don't like it, but it is what the voters said. And we have to follow the will of the voters because it's in the Constitution. And so, yes, they ignored two different 70% elections that stated the will of Ohio voters to get rid of extreme gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering. They ignored it. So now we have citizens, not politicians, to say, you know what? We can't trust the politicians to draw the lines in accordance with our wishes as voters of Ohio. So we're going to take it out of their hands. We're going to put it in the hands of 5 non-politician, non-lobbyist Democrats, five nonpartisan, non-politician Republicans, and five independents that are in many ways appointed by retired judges, and let them just be about creating fair boundaries that allow for competition and accountability, and therefore innovation.
The rules matter, and they don't just matter to Jeff Birding. They matter a lot to Governor Mike DeWine. He served as chair of the Redistricting Commission in 2021, and while the governor agrees it did not go as anyone had hoped, he doesn't think the Citizens Not Politicians Amendment is the way to solve gerrymandering.
Well, look, I don't think there's any doubt that throughout history, whoever was drawing the map drew some crazy districts. I think there is now a consensus that we don't want to do that. I think we are beyond that in this state, at least. And so the question is, what do we do to replace it? That's really what the issue is. Look, there's a lot of different ways of doing this. I think it's interesting. I've lived long enough to remember a lot of debates, and the editorial boards, people who are really focused on good government, have always said we want compact districts. They have always said we want communities of interest to be together. They've always said we don't really want political subdivisions divided up. And the reason we don't want those divided up is because we elect people by districts, and we think that voter needs to have that relationship with that person who represents them. So, you know, that's always been what we've done. And I think that the voters need to understand, if this passes, all of that, all the things that you sort of grew up thinking were good government, all of them are thrown away. Now, if that's what we want to do, you know, we can do that. But I think it's important for voters to actually understand what is at stake here and what this amendment does. And I think the other side, frankly, has spent an awful lot of time talking about citizens drawing the maps. And that's fine. You could certainly come up with a proposal that way. That's what the most important thing, though, it seems to me, is what the legal criteria is that they have to follow.
We're going to hear more from the governor in episode 3, How to Draw Fair Maps. But first, we need to understand how gerrymandering impacts our communities. That's coming up when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Untangled. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're unraveling redistricting this season, and we've arrived at how gerrymandering impacts our communities. So I want you to pause for just a moment and imagine your own community, the place that you call home. What makes it your community? How do you define its boundaries? Do you draw a line around your school district, your subdivision, maybe the delivery radius of your favorite restaurant? Does your community all root for the same sports team, work for the same major employer? If I handed you a pen and said, circle your community on a map, where would you put down those lines? These are the kinds of questions that arise when mapmakers are told to keep communities of interest together. They're hard questions because there's no one way to define a community. And yet, somehow, we recognize that having lawmakers come from a place, be from this town or that, is beneficial. Which leads me to my next question. What happens when we split communities apart? University of Cincinnati professor David Niven has been studying this question, and he's drilling down on Ohio's 6th congressional district, which runs 200 miles along our eastern border. David, this district splits some cities and this small little town called Gnada Hutton. Can you explain what's going on in this teeny tiny town?
Well, a couple of things happen when they cut your little town in half. And in this case, a town that could fit inside a congressional district 600 times. And the biggest thing in terms of politics is you confuse people because they look out there, literally out their front door, and they see a yard sign for a congressional candidate, and they can't vote for that candidate because they're in a different district, because their town's been split in half. You know, they look to the political organizations of the town, you know, for, you know, information about who's running, who they should vote for, and all of that gets muddled. They look to the media for information. All of that gets muddled. And then, of course, you get to this bottom line that members of Congress pay less attention when they only have part of a town. Of course they do. They've got a lot of towns to worry about and a lot of people to worry about. So in this case, Gnadenhutton is one of those tiny little towns. This is a town that has an apple butter festival, for goodness sake. This is a town where they bring in horses in the you know, in the fall for the festival, and everybody literally stands around a cauldron of boiling apples. This is like a picture postcard out of a movie Ohio town. And like so many other places, it's one of those places that was targeted for gerrymandering because, you know, the lines aren't drawn to be good to the people of Gnadenhutton.
Yeah, there are about 1,200 people live there. So very teeny tiny town when we're talking small. Slightly larger is the city of Maslin, also in northeastern Ohio. It is split between two congressional districts. And what's interesting here is something you just touched on, that some residents end up in this castaway news market. Can you explain what that is?
Well, the real difficulty is when you look to the media for help finding out what's going on, and most of the folks in your county are in one congressional district, you're far more likely to hear about that race. You're far more likely to hear about those candidates and not hear about the person who actually represents you or the race that's actually in your area. And you get some of these towns where, you know, three quarters or four fifths of the folks are in one congressional district. Naturally, everything they hear is about the district they don't live in. And there's some great studies about this that just make it absolutely definitive. When you do this to people, it creates confusion. Of course it does. How could it not? If what they're seeing is news about a one member of Congress who doesn't represent them. And you know, bring this locally, you know, Delaware County is a great example of a place that's bearing the burden of this. Delaware County is split into pieces, and one side of it is with a congressional district that goes all the way to within one county of West Virginia, and the other side of it's in a congressional district that goes all the way to within one county of Indiana. You're just making it harder for those voters to understand, to know who's who, and to get attention in that situation.
We often think of our school districts as communities of interest, and the 6th congressional district splits some in half. One you highlighted stuck out to me again because it's so small. The Strasburg-Franklin local school district has two buildings, an elementary school and a combined middle and high school. So literally two buildings. How on earth did that school district end up in two different congressional districts?
Well, that's right. I mean, think about that. You get two schools and you get two members of Congress. You know, if Congress, you know, seats were handed out on that basis nationwide, we'd have hundreds of thousands of members of Congress.
And that would be wild.
Thankfully, yeah, exactly. Thankfully, they're not. So the short answer to your question is because the desire was to preserve as many Northeast strong Republican districts as possible. So the lines had to be drawn and cut Tuscarawas County and Stark County in a very surgical way. And that didn't leave room for worrying about Massillon's school district. And in fact, statewide, more than 60 school districts are split between congressional districts, some even smaller than the one you just mentioned.
What happens when a school district gets split? It's got to be harder to advocate for their interests.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you think about, you know, a district trying to reach out to a member of Congress, maybe inviting them to be their graduation speaker, trying to do anything to build a relationship there. And you've just made it twice as hard. You've literally made it twice as hard because you're that much smaller a part of their district. And by definition, because you've been sliced into pieces, you're on the edge of their congressional district. It's not like you're in the very geographic center of it. So you're struggling multiple ways to get their attention. And, you know, these are very real needs. I mean, federal education policy, you know, support for, you know, students with special needs and so forth. I mean, these are profoundly important issues in local school districts that you're placing some of our smallest districts in a double bind in terms of trying to just be heard.
And one of the things about districts, particularly at the statehouse level, is that they nest. So very often we like to say we have 99 members of the Ohio House. They fit into 33 Senate districts. And those Senate districts, for the most part, they try to keep them within congressional districts. So if you get split at one level or the other, you're probably going to get split all the way up and down.
Well, that's certainly a burden. And even in that nesting, Ohio, it doesn't require that, but it does a fairly poor job of it. And what winds up happening is you may have so many state house members in your congressional district that it gets in the way of the relationship between the member of Congress and the state house member, because the member just has too many state house members to deal with. And you see states that do better than Ohio, and almost every state does better than Ohio. What they tend to do is they do a fairer job of splitting the, you know, state house districts within the congressional districts to make those relationships stronger.
We've been talking about communities map makers split apart, but I also want to talk about the ones that get combined. The 6th District has counties where manufacturing is the number one employer, communities where oil and gas extraction is the number one employer, which means part of the district wants energy prices to be low to keep their operational costs down, and part of the district wants energy prices to be high to maximize their profits. David, how do lawmakers represent these competing interests? Do they just have to pick a side?
Well, that's really what we're talking about here when you get to the bottom line. That, you know, it isn't a question of how good is your member of Congress. They can't be on both sides of an issue and represent the people of your district. How good is your member of Congress? It doesn't matter. The question is, how good is your district? That's going to tell you what kind of representation you're getting. So in the example you just gave, a member can't simultaneously advocate for high energy prices and low energy prices. They can't simultaneously advocate for an atmosphere that makes life as easy as possible for manufacturers and one that makes it as easy as possible for the energy industry. So the bottom line in these kinds of cases is we get these unrepresentable districts where they're built on extremes, they're built on disparities, in this case, built on an economic contradiction. So even if you want to, and nobody's saying members of Congress run for office to not do a good job representing their people, but the practical reality, how can I represent diametrically opposing notions? How can I represent diametrically opposing economic interests? That's really, really hard to do.
It doesn't just happen in the 6th Congressional District. The 5th District runs from Cleveland to our western border, pitting agricultural interests that lobby against certain runoff mitigation against communities that live on Lake Erie, where that runoff causes toxic algae blooms. So you have farmers on one hand, and then you have people who live on the shore of Lake Erie, and they have very opposing ideas when it comes to wastewater and runoff.
Absolutely. And you know, we could take a tour of the state, the first district that combines Cincinnati and Warren County, for example, where, you know, Warren County is full of the richest Ohioans and Cincinnati has many of the poorest Ohioans. We could go really regionally around and find these examples, you know, and the environmental one is another good one. Which way are you pushing? Are you farm first or are you, you know, environmental quality of air and water first? You know, these districts, there's some great research. There was a political scientist who for a long time followed members of Congress around, you know, with their permission and wrote about what they saw and who they talked to and how they did their job. And the number one thing that he found was what they were able to do was represent the community as they found it. They couldn't change it. They couldn't do magic powers and take two things that were opposites and make them the same. But where the people had fundamental things in common, they could be represented well. And so these examples that you're giving, you can't be pro-manufacturing and pro-energy when they have diametrically opposed interests. You can't be pro-quality of water and pro-farming when they have diametrically opposed interests. You can't be for the biggest of business and the, you know, the smallest and most vulnerable person. You know, that's the challenge of these districts, and it's the price that Ohioans pay, because whichever side of that you're on, you're not being heard as clearly because the other side of it's in the exact same district.
We should be clear, though, that some splitting is inevitable. There's no way to draw a map that doesn't split something. One great example is Columbus is too big to fit in a single congressional district. The cutoff is about 760,000 people per federal congressional district. Our city has more than 900,000 residents. Hamilton County is also too big to fit in a district. But as you said earlier, Delaware County is not. It could, arguably, be combined with parts of Franklin, the suburbs around the city. The people who commute to Columbus Congressional District, you could argue that's a community. And I say you could maybe make a case for drawing a donut district around the city of Columbus, right? Suburban communities unite. But our current map splits the suburbs of Columbus into three different districts, including the 12th that goes all the way from Olentangy schools to Massillon, Ohio schools. Those are wildly different communities.
Well, that's right. And you're right to say, of course, lines have to be drawn somewhere. Some, you know, there literally have to be boundaries. That's the nature of the game. But they don't have to be drawn without any interest in what these people are about culturally, what these people are about economically. They don't have to be drawn to minimize the connection across, you know, across the state. I'll give you another Delaware County example. Delaware County is one of the best insured populaces in the country in terms of healthcare access, one of the best in the nation. Holmes County in Ohio is literally the second least insured county in the country. And those are both in that, you know, in that district. And, you know, that's the kind of thing where how is a member of Congress going to sensibly represent a county that has the most health insurance in the nation and a county that has the least? Well, they can't. And to split the difference isn't to serve either of those places well.
Yeah, when you look at Columbus and its suburbs, like one of the things I keep coming back to is you could really make a case that the suburbs all are a community of interest. There is disappearing farmland, rising home prices. As Columbus continues to develop, the ones on the west, on the east side, all have to deal with Intel and the growth that that's going to bring. But they're all in different districts.
Well, I think your fundamental premise is quite right, that these people have an awful lot in common. And as we touched on a little bit earlier, they share a common media orbit, which would make the district even that much more valuable, that much easier for folks to pay attention. And, you know, those things you mentioned, I mean, they sound a little abstract, but the fact that they're a lot of commuting in the same direction, the fact that they share, you know, sort of basic transportation issues and traffic issues, these are real things in common. And you know, they're not heard when you split all the sort of, you know, surroundings of Columbus into different districts. What you're doing is you're taking that voice and just diluting it so that each bit of it is just a little piece of a different district.
And you can make the case that the reason we have so many districts that touch on the Columbus suburbs and spread outward across the state is because we have one Democratic congressional member in Columbus, Joyce Beatty, and then we're surrounded by three Republicans, Mike Carey, Jim Jordan, and Troy Balderson.
Well, that's right. That's the bottom line, that, you know, the way the map was drawn and obviously drawn by a majority Republican commission was to mitigate the damage to Republicans. So you didn't want to create a district in and around Franklin County that would create a second Democratic opportunity. So you split those and you literally divided them in every direction. You sent some west, you sent some east, you sent some south to try and keep that from happening.
So how do we define communities of interest? We're going to get into this a little bit in our next episode next week on how we draw fair maps, but there is no one answer, right? Like how I define community is not perhaps the way you define it.
Well, you're exactly right to say there is no one answer. And, you know, the short answer to your question is people have some significant things in common. And in some places, I mean, you can come up with some scenarios, you know, people who live in an island community or something, you know, where everything is in common, you know, economically, culturally, and so forth. For us, it's really, it's a weighing of different factors against each other. But one thing that's probably easier to say is we know it when we don't see it. And when you combine Holmes County and Delaware County, you know that is not a community of interest and we can work towards something better.
One of my favorite things from studying California's redistricting that focused entirely on communities was they went around the state and they asked people, what is your community? And there was a community outside of Los Angeles where they had permits to have horses and to take them up in the mountains. And they were like, we are a community of interest. All of our horse-zoned properties need to be in the same district.
Right. And you know, I've had a a commissioner from the Michigan Independent Commission speak in class, and he talked about how, you know, when they went out and listened to folks, they created a coastal district that looked a little funny when you saw it, but it was people who had very, very similarly shared economic interests because their economies were so dependent on tourism. So the district was a little longer and less wide than you might imagine, but it actually fit how people saw themselves and lived their lives.
Next week, we're untangling how we draw fair maps, what it means to pack and to crack voters, and whether the real solution to gerrymandering might just be to live in more diverse neighborhoods. Make sure to tune in Monday at 11, only on 89.7 NPR News.